We're in James chapter 3 in our study in verse 17, and we're working our way through the verse here, looking at these parts of the heart of God that he describes as this wisdom that is from above that we need to have in us, which is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, and easy to be entreated, full of mercy and good fruits. The last part says, without partiality and without hypocrisy. And that's what we need to look at tonight, we do not need to be having anything in here that says without. God's wisdom is without that. So up to now, we've been looking at these things that it is. We see there's a lot of things that it is not. He's already mentioned that bitter envying and strife that is part of that wisdom that is not from above. But partiality and hypocrisy are not part of the wisdom of God. Is there anything that's described here in God's wisdom? I mean, where is wisdom? If we're going to have it, where is it going to be? It's going to be in our spiritual hearts. So, therefore, is there anything that we can have of wisdom that's not part of the heart? And so when he's describing this wisdom that is from above, is this part of the heart of God, since it's from him? I mean, are we reading anything in verse 17 that doesn't go along with other passages of Scripture that we have in the New Testament, particularly that teach us about the parts of God's love and of the divine nature? I mean, this goes right along with that. And it's described in different ways in different passages, but it's teaching the same principle or same point. For example, when he's teaching in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, that we all know is a chapter that speaks about the love of God, he plainly says that, well, it's translated charity in the King James Version. It's agape, the Greek word for love. Love is, and then he tells us what God's love is, and then he says it is not, and he tells us several things that it is not or does not do. It suffers long, it is kind, it does not envy, is not puffed up, and so on. But in 1 Corinthians 13, when he's directly teaching God's love is and God's love is not, I mean, he's showing us side by side, things that are part of God's love. And if we were looking at 1 John 4:8, what is the word that describes the nature of God, the heart of God? God is love. So he's describing the divine nature there, and in 1 Corinthians 13, but he'll tell us God's love, these are the things that are part of God's love, that are part of the heart of God. These other things are not. We can also look at the book of Ephesians. In chapter 3 that we know well, the prayer is that we would know the breadth and length and depth and height of the love of Christ. So there it is again. And be filled with all the fullness of God. And then in chapter 4, he gets into the particular parts, but how does he present it in Ephesians 4? It's the old man versus the new man, which is exactly how he teaches it in Colossians chapter 3. So we have God's love is, God's love is not. We have the old man with his deeds, and the new man, which is in the image of Christ. Well, what is of the new man? Is that any different than what's the parts of the love of God? Galatians 5, the fruit of the Spirit, the works of the flesh. So whether it's love is not, new man, old man, fruit of the Spirit, works of the flesh, or here, the wisdom that is from above, the wisdom that is not from above. All of these different passages that teach us these things, or may be describing it using some different words to approach it, but what he's teaching is similar or the same or different. He's teaching us about what is part of the heart of God, what must be in us, because what is the goal here in verse 2 of this very chapter that is repeating the goal that was set out for us at the beginning of the book in chapter 1, especially 2 through 4? I mean, what are we ultimately aiming for? Why do we count it all joy when we fall into diverse temptations? Why do we need to bridle our tongues? What do we need to in our whole body also? The goal is for us to be that complete man, entire, lacking nothing. Well, that's where this, he's bringing us back to that here at the end of the chapter. So this is what we have in our hearts in order for us to be able to bridle our tongues and our whole body also. We've got to have this wisdom that is from above, but he's describing God's nature, and not to have the things that it is not. So when we speak of the goal of chapter 1 and verse 4, when we let patience have a perfect work, that patience that comes by enduring those trials on our faith, that we become perfect and entire, wanting nothing, or James 3:2, that the one who does not offend in word, the same as a perfect man and able also to bridle the whole body. To reach that goal of perfection, is that merely talking about what we cannot be lacking in? I mean, that is a major part of it, as we know. And we need to be perfect and entire, lacking nothing, lacking none of these things that are part of the heart of God. If we're lacking any of them, how can we be complete if we're lacking something? But at the same time, what if we have these things, but we also have things in us that are contrary to or not part of the heart of God? That would not be something that we're lacking in if we have it, but those are things that we need to be lacking in, don't we? What do we need to do with those things? That's why he said first pure. That was the word he used in verse 17. It's first pure. It has to be clean, purged from all these other things. And I know that many times in lessons that I've taught on, that when we're looking at the subject, generally trying to understand what being complete means, probably the most direct passage where we find a definition of the word, I mean, a descriptive definition of the word, is in the Old Testament, in the book of Leviticus, in chapter 22, when he's describing the animal sacrifices there, because he says that those sacrifices that were offering had to be perfect to be accepted. So in verses 21 through 23, he said, "And whosoever offereth the sacrifice of peace offerings unto the Lord to accomplish his vow, or a free will offering in beeves or sheep, it shall be perfect to be accepted. There shall be no blemish therein. Blind or broken or maimed or having a wind or scurvy or scab, you shall not offer these unto the Lord, nor make an offering by fire of them upon the altar unto the Lord, either a bullock or a lamb that hath anything superfluous or lacking in his parts. That mayest thou offer for a freewill offering, but for a vow it shall not be accepted." So when he is describing these animal sacrifices and said in verse 21 that they had to be perfect to be accepted, in the Old Testament, tom or tamam, they're two forms of the same word, like we see several forms of the word teleos in the New Testament in Greek. In Greek, we have two synonyms, really, teleos and artios, and we'll find forms of those two different words that both mean complete. In the Hebrew, there's really one basic word that we find most often that has the same meaning. And it's what is used to describe Job, and what is used to describe Noah, who was perfect in his generations, what Abraham was commanded to be. And so there are several times that word is used to describe certain ones of God's servants who had grown to that point spiritually. Same meaning as the Greek words that we have in the New Testament that mean the same thing. And what he teaches in the Old Testament about it is identical. But here he's using that word describing animals that were to be sacrificed. Well, what is the difference between Noah being perfect in his generations and Job was a perfect man versus these animals were to be perfect to be accepted? Same word, but what's the big difference? That's exactly it. Physical versus spiritual. When he's talking about these animals that were to be sacrificed, when he said they were to be perfect to be accepted, he was not talking about their spiritual growth and what the status of that was. Because, I mean, one of those, a bullock or a sheep, I mean, do they grow spiritually? I mean, they're not made in the image of God. They're not going to be able to spiritually grow like we can and must. He's not talking about the spiritual application of it there, but he's talking about physically, and he gives examples of that. But the word has the same meaning. And what does he say about what is the definition of? Because we're going to say, well, what is the word when he says perfect to be accepted? It means complete. What does that mean for an animal? Well, what does verse 23 tell us? What is being complete? What is the definition of complete? You're not going to find a better one than what's right there in verse 23 when he says that has anything superfluous or lacking in his parts. And that covers both sides. What does superfluous mean? Extra. And then or lacking. So, I mean, there's certain body parts they were to have physically. But it means, I mean, to be complete means you have all the parts and you're not missing any and you don't have anything additional. Because if you do, you're not complete. So we have to understand that properly. It's not only what we must have, but it's also what we must get rid of. And we see that, I mean, find the time when he's describing the nature of God where he doesn't teach us here's what it is and also here's what it isn't. And that's why we see God's love is and is not. And that's why we see the new man, the old man, fruit of the Spirit, works of the flesh, the wisdom that is from above, the wisdom that is not from above. That contrast is always there. Here's what we need to have, what we must have and not be lacking in. Here's what we need to purge out. And so we're seeing that again here in James 3:17, now here at the end, without partiality and without hypocrisy. So looking at the verse in total, I mean, can we be complete, or can we be that complete man, bridle our tongues and our whole body also, if we're not pure, peaceable, gentle, easy to be entreated, and full of mercy and good fruits? No. What about if we have partiality and hypocrisy in us? No, because then we have something, God, that's not part of the nature of God, part of the heart of God. That's got to go. That must be purged out. So let's look at that a little bit more in more detail. Because these are, especially this first one, without partiality, maybe we don't give that as much attention as we should in our study or our thoughts or efforts. When we're thinking of the things that God's love isn't and that his wisdom isn't, is that one that usually jumps in there as far as what we're thinking about typically? Maybe not, but it needs to be part of it because God mentions that and right here. So without partiality, this word, it's a long one, adiakritos is the Greek word here. 87 is the number in Strong's if you want that, but literally it means undistinguished. Now, when we think of somebody, if we think of somebody who's undistinguished, that's usually something that would be a negative thing. Somebody hasn't accomplished anything, so they haven't done anything to distinguish themselves. Well, but if we think about the word distinguished, if you're making a distinction, I mean, that's what that is. So, without partiality, and this is the word with the Greek letter alpha in front of it. That's why the Strong's number is so low, 87. It's alphabetical. But when you have that, that's the negative particle in Greek, meaning not. So it's not distinguished, without partiality. So partiality is when you make a distinction. Well, we're not supposed to make, there are certain kinds of distinctions we're supposed to make and certain kinds we're not supposed to make. We've already seen this, haven't we? What chapter in this book? It was really the first half of chapter 2, wasn't it? Verses 1 through 13 in particular. As he started off chapter 2 with saying, "My brethren, have not the faith of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Lord of glory, with respect of persons." Well, that's a way we're not supposed to distinguish between one and another. Respecter of persons, which what did we learn that that means in the literal sense? What is persons? It's faces. So it's the outward appearance. Or if we're making distinction between one or another, especially our brethren, on things that pertain, that are physical or pertain to the outward man, the appearance, well, then what does he say? What did we learn in chapter 2 that makes us guilty of? If we have respect of persons in chapter 2, verse 9, what do we commit? He says you commit sin. So that's it's a commandment of God not to distinguish on that basis. What does that mean? We don't make any distinction? We don't distinguish between anything or from one to another on any basis? In honor, we're supposed to prefer one another, aren't we? Do we have preference for God's children, our brethren? Is that a good or a bad thing? Does he command us to, in honor, prefer one another in Romans 12? Yes, we are to prefer one another. We're to do good as we have opportunity unto all men, Galatians chapter 6, verse 10, especially whom? Those who are of the household of faith. Are we supposed to show a preference for the household of faith of one another? Does God have the same love for those that are in his family that he's adopted as his children as to those who are of the world? He's made us all. But in the end, is God going to make a distinction? He makes a distinction now, and that is going to end up being a permanent one after Judgment Day. I mean, God is going to judge, and he's sheep and goats. I mean, God distinguishes between sheep and goats. Do we? Okay. That's right. And when we were studying in James chapter 2, that was a major point that we looked at. And how many scriptures do we have that show God is not a respecter of persons? He's not a respecter of faces. Again, we need to have the heart of God. We need to judge like God does. And that's not based on the outward man. As we were looking at, and we won't have to go back through and repeat all that we studied on that point when we were in chapter 2, but do we as Christians, are we commanded to judge? And this is a problem that we see a lot of people make. I mean, how many people quote Matthew 7:1 and pretend like or act like it's just an isolated statement that has no other context to it, that there's nothing before or after it in Matthew, and that there's no other verse in the Bible about it either? I mean, how many people take that out? Judge not that you be not judged, and just lift that out, and that's pretty much that's the Bible in a statement for many. I mean, it's kind of the way it is. It seems to be that way. And how many people today is like, don't judge? The words you hear all the time is like, don't judge and don't shame me. Well, if there were more, if they were being judged more for their bad behavior and they were capable of being ashamed of it, that would be a good thing, wouldn't it? We'd see a lot less of what we got going on, but now that we live in a time when all judgment is condemned and no one, and the worst thing in the world is to feel guilt or shame about anything, then what do you get? What we've got. And it's not good. But Christians, are we commanded not to judge? Well, there's a, as we saw when we were, again, when we were in James, James chapter 2, we studied about that. But Matthew 7, verse 1, that first part, judge not that you be not judged. That wasn't a one statement. That's part of the Sermon on the Mount, which was a lot more than one statement. And there's a lot before and after it. There's a particular kind of judging that he's commanding us not to engage in, and it's the hypocritical kind, which is another reason we see without partiality, without hypocrisy. There they are together in James 3:17. But we cannot judge with hypocrisy. That is, if somebody's doing something and we're doing the same thing and we condemn them for it when we're doing the same thing, then what are we? And so if there's a mode in our brother's eye and we've got a beam in our own eye, when we're, which is the same of kind, the difference is degree. And so in that sense, we're doing the same thing, but even worse. I mean, what business do we have of condemning somebody else when we're doing the same thing? We're not to do that. But does the Lord forbid all judgment then? No. So we're not to judge as hypocritically when we're doing the same thing. We're also not to judge by the outward man, but what does John 7:24 say? Judge not according to the appearance, which that would be with the partiality, respect of persons, but he says, but judge righteous judgment. So there's a commandment in John 7:24. That's one of the places we're commanded to judge. But on what basis? Well, like God did in 1 Samuel 16. You remember when the sons of Jesse were brought before Samuel, and Eliab, the first of Jesse's sons, David's oldest brother, was brought first. They were appearing in birth order, and there was Eliab, Mr. Tall and Handsome, who in the next chapter was condemning David when David was ready to go fight Goliath. Did Eliab, was his heart like David's? Mm-mm. No. But when Samuel saw him, he said, surely the Lord's anointed is before me. But what did God tell him? Don't look on the height of his stature, on his countenance, for I have refused him. For the Lord sees not as man sees. And so he told him, that we to not judge by the sight of his eyes there, that God looks on the heart. And that's what God was. Did God distinguish between Eliab and David? Very much so. Based on what? David was a man after God's own heart. He made a distinction based on their hearts. How about Cain and Abel? Same reason. How about Jacob and Esau? How about us in the world? And we are commanded to judge, to see and judge like God does. And so by the heart, we are to make distinction. So when we are showing preference to our brethren, and if we're not distinguishing on that basis, remember Matthew 25 when he gives that picture of the judgment from verses 31 to 46 when he separates the sheep from the goats, and then he speaks to those sheep on his right hand. And then what is the main point in that judgment scene of Matthew 25 is the basis that the Lord is going to be pardoning his sheep that he separated on the right hand. Whether they have served Christ, and he says, when you've done this unto one of the least of these, my brethren, you've done it unto me. Is it important that we identify who our brethren are, who are the Lord's children, and that we show preference in our love and our service to each other? As we have, therefore, opportunity, we are to do good unto all men, but especially to each other. And that's how he's going to judge us. So if we look at that and understand that properly, we'll be following it, and we're going to be distinguishing between those that are God's children and those that are not, just like the Lord does, and prefer one another. Now, if we prefer those that we associate with in our lives, and we all have people in our lives that aren't God's children, and that's the way God would have it to be, because we're to be the light of the world and the salt of the earth. And so it is God's will that we be in contact with those that are in this world. Is it God's will that we all physically separate ourselves from the world? And I mean, it sounds appealing in a lot of ways, but I mean, you could just build a big wall around a compound somewhere, and we just stick to each other. Well, it's not time for heaven yet. While we're here, we can't do that. Why not? We have to influence the world. Of course, it's also the Lord's will that we be tested by. I mean, who's going to be the ones to persecute us and to bring those trials on our faith? So there's that, but it's not going to suit God's purposes for us to be removed from everybody in the world. But if that's who we prefer, if we prefer being around those people, if we like people of the world that we're around better than our brethren, we got a major problem, a major spiritual problem, because we're not distinguishing correctly by the heart and showing preference for God's people. I mean, how can we be part of God's family, but we don't really like his family? If we said, well, I like the father of the family, it's just all the siblings I have in there that I'd rather be with that. I mean, that is not the proper, if we do that, I mean, what is 1 John 4, what is the way that we show that we love God whom we have not seen? Whom we have seen, yeah, each other. So we need to do that, and that needs to be our preference. That needs to be what we are chiefly engaged in trying to do, to love each other, to serve one another, and exhort and edify each other, and do good for one another in every way that we can out of our love for each other, based on our love for God. I mean, those are the first two commandments. And the new commandment that we love one another as Christ has loved us. So this is central to Christianity. Brother Jan?
Part of that fear of the Lord is to love good. And who is it that's going to be doing good if yes. They're not doing good according to God's definition
of good? It's just God's children, it's not the world. That's exactly right. At the same time, we do know it's true that, as he teaches us in that parable of the wheat and tares in Matthew 13, the devil does sow tares in the kingdom. And sometimes when we run across that, the devil's going to try to take advantage of that and say, hey, look at this over here, and then try to make us not love the good, the ones who are doing good and serving the Lord, because of somebody that's got a problem. Sometimes they're not tares, they're just weak. We've got to bear with their infirmities. So there are a lot of parts to this, but yes, we have to love what is good. And I mean, why was David's heart knit with Jonathan's? I mean, it was their mutual faith in God and their love for righteousness. They had that in common. That was, I mean, how else would you have, and there was an age difference. I mean, Jonathan was quite a few years David Sr. We don't know the exact number, but you can look at David's age, and Jonathan was the firstborn son. He was around early in his father's reign. We know that David was 30 years old when he began to reign, when Saul died. So just looking at the numbers that we have, we know that Jonathan was a good bit older than David. So they were not, I mean, when we look at all the, we look at pictures in the children's storybook, Bible storybooks, if they have David and Jonathan, of course, they always show them like they're, and we might think in our own minds because of their close friendship that they were peers as far as age. They weren't. Jonathan was quite a bit older. He would have had to have been. Not only that, he was the heir to the throne that David was going to end up taking. As far as earthly speaking, I mean, was there any reason or any way those two could have been anything but bitter enemies? No. But here they were with their hearts knit together. Because they had their faith in common, and they loved God and they loved righteousness, unlike anybody else around in their time that we read about. I mean, they were those two stood above all the rest, and so they saw those qualities in each other, and they loved that. So they loved one another on that basis, and that's the way it does need to be for all of us. If we love righteousness and hate iniquity, I mean, when we can come together, I mean, here we are in this city, and we got a lot of different backgrounds here that we come from, but we believe the same things, and we love the same things, and we have this in common. We don't have with anybody else. And it's something very precious. That's a like precious faith that we have. And that needs to be dear to all of us. So when he says without partiality, he's not telling us not to make any distinction between righteousness and wickedness, or those who are following righteousness versus those who are following wickedness. It's speaking about on another basis that we would be showing partiality. That is something that is not part of the nature of God if we're doing that. So this would fit together with what we saw in chapter 2 without partiality. Meaning that we are not showing, making our distinctions one from another on the wrong basis, such as being a respecter of persons that we've already looked at there. Now, as I mentioned, the word adiakritos, well, the separating that negative particle and just looking at the part that's the distinguish, diakruo is the Greek word, is the other part of the compound word there, which literally means to separate thoroughly. And that was a word he used in chapter 2, verse 4, when he said, "Are you not then partial in yourselves and are become judges of evil thoughts?" So this is a form of that exact word he used in chapter 2 when he was on that subject of teaching against respecting persons, respecting faces, judging by the outward man. God doesn't do that, so that wisdom that is from above doesn't do that. And when we have the wisdom of God, we can't do that. So here's another, I mean, we've seen this a lot in the study of the book of James, things that he will, particular points or topics that are addressed as we go through the book earlier, they tend to be revisited or will come up again and get tied into something else, especially tied into other things that he has brought out. So we're seeing points made and then putting it all, blending it together and putting it all together for us, for our, which is really what the word understanding is. Particularly the Greek word is when we're mentally putting together. The Lord's putting it all together for us when he brings back these things that he's talked about. So in chapter 1, he spoke to us, taught us about the importance of not, how we need to be lacking nothing, and then went immediately to, if any of you lack wisdom. Now he's been teaching about this wisdom of God here, and then says that is without partiality, which is something that he was teaching us not to do in chapter 2, not to respect persons. And recall, what was the example that he used in chapter 2? How they were respecting persons. What outward characteristic? I mean, there are a lot of them. I mean, there are a lot of different outward characteristics that we're capable of judging by, and they're all wrong. But which was the one that they were goofing up or tripping over in chapter 2? Yeah, based on how much money they had, rich versus poor. And so the ones who somebody, I know we mentioned it at the time, but that very issue is still alive and well in our time. That is certainly in existence. If you haven't, I've seen this. There are certain places where congregations are, they're really based on things like that. I remember, I know some of the, there's so many congregations in the Nashville, Tennessee area, but some of them based on their neighborhood, it's not just their neighborhood, but some of the really posh ones, they aggregate together. They prefer each other. That's not a good way to, that's not the way the Lord would have us to judge. So as he uses that very example in James 2, not to do that. So it's interesting. It's pretty obvious that was a big problem, among the brethren, in that time. Half of James 2, that first half, the chapter, right after he's been teaching about in chapter 1, that last half of chapter 1 about not being hearers but doers of the word. And then the second half of James 2, very similarly, is about how our faith, to be a living faith, has to have works. Well, to be a hearer and a doer, not a hearer only, to not believe only but have, with our faith, to have works to be complete. But sandwiched in between those two giant topics is that first half of James 2 that spends so much time dealing with that point about not being a respecter of persons. For that to be there in that place, and then for it to come up again when he says, here, this wisdom that is from above is without partiality. I mean, does that not clue us in that was a pretty sizable problem among the brethren in that time? And whatever the devil is successful with in one time, what's going to happen in all the other times? Does he just come up with brand new things every generation, the devil that is? I mean, does he start off each generation? Okay, now, I wonder what is going. Wonder what I can try to deceive this new batch with. I mean, is it really like that, or does he have his devices that he's been using from the beginning that succeed over and over and over again. There's nothing new under the sun. That's exactly right. And that's true also of the devil's work. The things that he's succeeded in deceiving man with, going back to the very beginning, his methods have been well tested and exercised, and he's very successful with those things. And, I mean, the fact that maybe there are technological advances, it just makes it easier for him to spread his lies and to use those same techniques to deceive. But when we read in the scriptures about a problem that men have had, we can guarantee that men are going to be having problems with the same thing in our own time. Yes. It always is. It can blend across it, but I mean, it's going to fit at least into one of those categories, just like from the beginning. And then the way that he presents the particular ways that he uses deception to get people to love those things of the world. I mean, they're successful over and over again, and I mean, that's a big one there. So we saw it extensively in chapter 2, but he's bringing it up again here in chapter 3, verse 17, when he says that the wisdom that is from above is without partiality, reminding us that God is not a respecter of persons. And if we do that, as he said in chapter 2, verse 9, then we're committing sin. When he said in verse 16 of chapter 3 that where envying and strife is, there's confusion in every evil work. Would we expect to see partiality respecting persons and whatever confusion and evil works that can produce be in the middle of all that too? Very much so. That's part of that devilish wisdom. It is not from God, and it must not have any part in us. And without hypocrisy, which is the last part of verse 17 there, we might like to think, or perhaps might like to think, that that should go without saying. But obviously it doesn't go without saying because he said it. So it must be important and it must be a problem. It must be a problem that can get us, for him to call our attention to it, to warn us about it so that we don't do that. The wisdom that is from above is without hypocrisy. So when we look at that particular word, anupokritos, which means literally to be undissembled, that second half of that compound word is a derivative of where we get the Greek word, the underlying word, hypocrites, what is our English word for somebody who's a hypocrite? They're a hypocrite. Well, I mean, we actually have a transliteration of that word. So basically, it's a form of that word with the negative particle attached, which is the without. So it's two words when we read it without, just like without partiality. It's just one compound word, not undistinguished. Well, here it is undissembled, but the dissembled is hypocrisy. And what does hypocritos mean in Greek? You ever look that up? I mean, yeah, it means hypocrite. Yeah, it does. But what is the actual word? It's interesting. It's literally an actor under an assumed character, like a stage player, an actor. Well, what do? I mean, what is acting? It's when you're pretending to be something that you're not. I mean, that's, you're pretending to be somebody else, some other character. So it's kind of interesting. It's that word that he uses and then makes a spiritual application to well, we don't need to be something, presenting ourselves as something different than what we are, when we are basically acting. And that's being, that's insincere, and that is hypocritical. Let's look at a few verses that teach us this point, and which is why he's mentioning it here. The fact that he does means we need to pay attention to it. Let's turn to Romans chapter 12, verse 9. Romans 12, verse 9. He says, "Let love be without dissimulation. Abhor that which is evil, and cleave to that which is good." In fact, it's the very next verse that says what? "In honor, preferring one another." So here in Romans chapter 12, 9 and 10, we find that same juxtaposition that we see in James 3:17. Well, but here verse 9 says, "Let love be without dissimulation." That's that same word, exact same word, that's without hypocrisy in James 3:17. But then when he says without partiality here in James 3:17, he tells us how we need to prefer one another. Obviously talking about two different things, two different ways of preference or distinguishing. We are to do so on a spiritual basis, not a physical basis. But our love, he says, let our love be without dissimulation. That is, I mean, without hypocrisy. That is, and then right there, as Brother Jan mentioned, what's right there in the midst of all of this? Abhor that which is evil, cleave to that which is good. Well, how can our love be, how can we be feigning something and be a hypocrite if we hate evil and cleave love and cleave to that which is good? See, there's nothing fake about that. If this is what we love and hate, then we're going to go according to that at all times. I mean, how can we, if we really love what is good, if we love righteousness, I mean, how are we ever going to be engaged in something, willingly engaged in something that is not consistent with a love of righteousness? And if we hate what is evil, I mean, how are we going to be over there involved in something evil, such that we are trying to present ourselves to be one who loves righteousness when we're actually, in fact, very much tangled up in wickedness? That's hypocrisy. And there's no room for that in Christianity, which should be obvious. But, I mean, what is the way to stay out of that? That fear of the Lord. I mean, what did we just read there in Romans 12, 9? Abhor that which is evil, cleave to that which is good. What is the difference between that and the fear of the Lord? That's really that's a half-verse summary of the fear of the Lord, Romans 12, 9. That is, the fear of the Lord is to hate evil. We know that. Proverbs 8:13. We all know Psalm 34:11-18. I mean, this is the basis of it. Loving righteousness, hating iniquity. And if we do that, then we would be, or should be, must be, sincere and unfeigned in our love and in all that we're doing. 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 6, just looking at a couple of other places where we find the same word that's in James 3:17, without hypocrisy. So in 2 Corinthians 6 and verse 6, this is where he was talking about, starting in verse 4, when he said, in all things approving ourselves as the ministers of God in... Well, that's a passage, by the way, that we need to know well, because if by God's inspiration, when the Apostle Paul is pointing out what was showing himself and those others that were with him and part of his that labor in the gospel of Christ, what made them approved as ministers of God, I mean, who was doing the approving? whose approval did they have? God's. If you have God's approval, do you have God's favor? Obviously so. So do we desire to please the Lord? Here's a list of, this is, I mean, you could put a heading here, really, how to please God. And then we have a list of several things underneath it. In much patience, in afflictions, in necessities and distresses and strife. Well, I'm not liking this list, some might be thinking, but if we understand what did we already study in James 1, 2 through 4, why should we like that list? Same reason we should count it all joy when we fall into these things right here. These are the trials on our faith that will help us grow. So when we are undergoing those trials, those afflictions for righteousness' sake and enduring them, do we have God's approval and do we win his favor then? I mean, that's the very thing he says in 1 Peter 2, 19 and 20, what grace, favor with God is, that we endure, patiently endure those persecutions for righteousness' sake. That's what they were doing. That's what Paul was doing in these others. In stripes, imprisonments, and tumults, and labors, and watchings, and fastings. Verse 6, by pureness, by knowledge, by long-suffering, by kindness, by the Holy Ghost, by love unfeigned. And that word unfeigned is that same word, without hypocrisy. Well, that should make sense. If you feign something, that means to fake it. If we're feigning our apparent goodness, well, then what are we? then we're a hypocrite. So he says, and notice it's interesting to see several of those things that are in James 3:17 that are of the wisdom of God. That the first part of this list in 2 Corinthians 6 of how we are approved by God as his servants are really focused on the different aspects or the ways in which we suffer temptation by afflictions for righteousness' sake. And then when you get to verse 6, here are the things that are produced by enduring that. And we see several of the things that are mentioned in James 3:17. What James 3:17 says, the wisdom that is from above is first what? Pure. What does he name there in verse 6? By pureness, by knowledge, by long suffering, by kindness. Is he not naming several of those good fruits that we see that are, these are all parts of the love of Christ, the love of God. And when we grow in those things by those afflictions he was just talking about, this is how we obtain God's approval, his favor. And he mentions by love unfeigned. So he mentions that without hypocrisy there of our love. So as he said in Romans 12:9, let our love be without dissimulation. That's the same word. It must be unfeigned, without hypocrisy. 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 5. 1 Timothy 1 verse 5. Now the end of the commandment is charity out of a pure heart and of a good conscience and of faith unfeigned. Unfeigned, again, same word. And so the end of the commandment, I mean, he's summarizing it here, love, God's love. The end of the commandment is love out of a pure heart. There we see just like the first, it is first pure. What was the first thing in 2 Corinthians 6, 6? By pureness. What is the first thing he mentions here? The end of the commandment is charity out of a pure heart. It's interesting to see these words coming up over and over again, and also the sequence bears a strong resemblance. And of faith unfeigned. Well, we saw in chapter 6, verse 6, love unfeigned, which is also what he said our love must be in Romans 12:9. Here he says faith unfeigned. So our love and our faith must be unfeigned, without hypocrisy. 2 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 5. This is what the Apostle Paul, by God's inspiration, wrote concerning Timothy. He says, "When I call to remembrance the unfeigned faith that is in thee, which dwelt first in thy grandmother Lois and thy mother Eunice, and I am persuaded that in thee also." An unfeigned faith. Just what he said the end of the commandment was in 1 Timothy 1:5. That was in the heart of Timothy. He was one that was very blessed to have been an heir of that from his mother and his grandmother, two generations before him. He had been grounded in those. In chapter 3, he goes back to that, how they had taught him those scriptures. I mean, they grounded him in the scriptures, but not just in memorizing a bunch of verses. They were obviously, well, to use the word there, they had a faith and it was unfeigned. They were sincere in their belief in what God spoke and in following it, to do it. And his grandmother and his mother taught him that. And he learned it from them. So here you have an unfeigned faith now in its third generation. Wouldn't we love to see that of our own? That was a real blessing, and that was something identified as being one of the characteristics that Timothy had. Last verse for tonight, 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 22. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 22. He says, "Seeing you have purified your souls," there's that word again, "purified your souls in obeying the truth through the Spirit from unto unfeigned love of the brethren. See that you love one another with a pure heart fervently." Well, there's the right distinguish or distinction to make, or the right way to distinguish that we love one another, but it must be with an unfeigned love of one another, with a pure heart, fervently. That's what we've been commanded to have and to follow, which is the wisdom that is from above. Well, we know how the Lord loves his family, and we are to love one another as he has loved us. And that same unfeigned love that Christ has for us needs to be in us towards one another. Lord willing, we'll continue our study from James 3 as we're getting close to the end of the chapter in our study. Lord willing, we'll continue that next Wednesday night.